welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast Season 3, culminating with the Layer 8 Conference on Saturday, October 8th in Providence, Rhode Island. This season, we'll have conversations with social engineers and OSINT investigators who will tell their stories. We hope you enjoy them.
Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have a really fun guest for you today. We have Dr. Abby Maronio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you describe a little bit about who you are?
So I am a behavioral and a social scientist. I'm the director of education at Social Engineer, a lecturer in psychology. I run my own research network and I run a consultancy company focused around perception management, nonverbal communication, and leadership. My areas of expertise lay within nonverbal communication, cooperation, and the psychological mechanisms underpinning human decision making. So I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's me.
One of the fun and exciting things about talking with you is the fact that you are a PhD and everything that you do is based in science and based on research, where normally on here I'm talking with practitioners, where people who do things based on probably sources that they've read, where you are one of the people that are creating that sources. You've done this work, you've done this research. Is that a good way to explain your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a researcher myself, but I'm also a peer reviewer. So one of my roles is to review publications when they're submitted to a journal, and basically assess it to see if it's good enough to be published and give recommendations. Yes, both researcher and peer reviewer.
And one of the things that I would think comes along with being a peer reviewer is determining what is valid science and what might not be either as valid science or even just pure rubbish. So I have some topics that I wanted to bring up with you and to see where you fall into line on some of these. So how about the first one that we bring up? Human lie detection. What do you think about that? Is there a way that you can sit across from somebody and ask them questions and read them and determine when they're lying?
So this is the first question that anybody gets when they say, I work in nonverbal communication or I work in behavioral analysis. The short answer is absolutely not. There is no such thing as a Pinocchio effect. There have been thousands of studies looking at body language and lie detection. There exists no empirical evidence that you can use nonverbal communication for lie detection. What we do know is we can use nonverbal communication with linguistics to facilitate questioning. But the short answer is absolutely not. I mean, it still shocks me that this is still a myth and that it's still so highly believed because there's so much empirical evidence demonstrating its pseudoscientific nature. And I never like to spend too much time addressing this because I get this question so often, but I think it's so important to address it. And to be honest, most of the literature on lie detection, or most of the misunderstanding of the literature, comes from micro expressions. It comes from, we watch Lie to Me, which is a series that is highly popular. And actually, watching Lie to Me has been shown through research to reduce accuracy at detecting deception. So just for anybody that isn't aware, micro expressions are fleeting facial expressions of emotion. So they last between 1/25th or half a second. And the theory behind the micro expressions for deception detection is that when we try and mask our true emotional state, these true emotional states kind of leak out before we get a chance to conceal them. So they're very, very fast. And it's called this kind of emotional leakage. And the concept is that we try and deceive someone. We feel a high degree of stress, discomfort, or a particular emotion, and then we try and conceal that. And if we can recognize these micro expressions, we can detect deception. There is some science to this. So the science of this is the fact that spontaneous facial expressions and deliberate facial expressions, they emanate from different upper motor neuron pathways, which are connected to the facial nerve. So basically, we can activate and deactivate facial muscles through this spontaneous pathway. Spontaneous pathway is called the cortical motor strip. So if I say to you, fake a smile or wink, you can do that without a problem. However, we have the other pathway, which is the extrapyramidal motor system. This is much harder to control. So when you feel an emotion, certain facial muscles will just activate. For example, your lip corner depresses just at the sides of your lips. They'll pull down when you're sad. It's very, very difficult to deliberately control these muscles because they come from that pathway. So what usually people will do is activate a muscle that they can control, for example, by raising their chin to try and emanate that sadness expression using the pathway they can control. And this is kind of where the science behind microexpressions ends. The fact that we do have these expressions that we can't control. This is just referring to expressions of emotion. This doesn't mean that they're quick, they're, you know, super fast. Actually, they're quite overt, so we notice them. The second thing is that the foundation of deception detection is flawed. So deception detection and microexpressions is just the expression of emotion. It's not the expression of deception. So when people claim they're reading cues of deception, as I just explained, it's just cues of emotion and high emotional arousal. And the important bit is we have these negative emotions associated with lying. A high degree of distress and discomfort of because of the fear of being found out. We also have the fear of being seen as a liar when we are telling the truth, which causes the exact same physiological response. You do not know what caused the emotional response. All you know is that there is emotional response. Also, not everybody feels a particular emotion when they're lying. If we self-deceive or we convince ourselves we're telling the truth, the nonverbal cues associated with that high emotional arousal don't occur. So the foundation of that in general is flawed. So there's so much research that we can talk about that show controversy to this idea of the existence of microexpressions or their utility for deception detection.
So that's a lot there that you just said isn't quite what I think a lot of the practitioners really enjoy. Like,
yeah,
destroying the Lie to Me TV show. Like, that just went straight to my heart. Knowing
I'm so sorry. I mean, to be honest, it went to my heart as well. I'll hold my hands in the air. I published my first two papers in lie detection. Because I watched Lie to Me, and that's what inspired me to go into behavioral analysis. I thought the idea behind it was fantastic, and it, like I said, it inspired me to become a psychologist. But when I published my first two papers, I definitely was naive. And because it is quite a widely accepted view, you can get research in there that isn't necessarily scientific. And what I was publishing was actually just, like I said, the expression of emotion. I was just looking at high distress and high discomfort, not lie detection. And when we look at studies retrospectively, so you have people that you know have lied versus truth tellers, you can unconsciously cherry pick your sample. And we also have confirmation bias. And this is what you see in a lot of research. They go back to people that have lied, people that have told the truth, and then assess those behaviors. But it's really, really easy then to notice a difference between the two. What is more effective is doing it in real time. And obviously research hasn't been able to do that. And most of them are done in lab studies, and there's, you know, serious flaws with doing lab studies. But as I said, you know, I started my work in this, and then I slowly moved to a different field because there just was no evidence supporting it. And most of the research that I really, really enjoyed, when I dived a bit deeper, what you realize is most of them have had replication studies. So people that have replicated those studies directly and actually found an entirely different result. So the original research on microexpressions, there was some research showing that people in the civil service were better at detecting lies. Replications of that study were done and found no evidence that they were better at detecting lies after microexpression training. The original studies have also been criticized for methodological flaws and lack of open science practices. So they wouldn't show their data, and nobody has been able to replicate those studies or their methodology. And there's actually research showing that training people in how to detect microexpressions reduces deception detection accuracy. And not only that, but microexpressions are very, very rare when they occur. There was studies done by Porter and Brink, who have been, you know, alongside DiPaolo, leaders in this field of debunking the nonverbal communication myths. And basically what they did was they looked at individuals who were either expressing true expressions or false expressions. And then they assessed the frames of the facial expressions. And they assessed like over 105,000 frames. And they found like 700 facial expressions. And only 14 times in that 700 was anything resembling microexpression. And it was the same for both truth tellers and liars. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think, you know, we've covered a pretty good ground here to show that it can actually be quite harmful to believe that deception detection is possible through nonverbal communication.
It sounds like really the best way to perform deception detection or figure out if somebody is lying is going to be really just down to through their statements and asking them the same questions different ways. Like I was thinking, like, how can law enforcement or anybody similar then figure out if somebody is lying? Because there's obviously going to be situations where it's to somebody's benefit to lie. And there are professions where it's their job to figure out who's lying. And would you say that that is probably about the only way now to figure out who's lying is either through objective facts or asking the same questions different ways?
Yes, so kind of like a tailored approach. Nonverbal communication itself is not good for deception detection. With nonverbal communication, you can detect high degrees of distress and discomfort. My own research, I look at how we can detect distress and discomfort. What that can do, though, is when you are questioning and you do see those emotions, they may be entirely unrelated to the questions that you're asking, but it does give you a point of interest that you can kind of pick up on and then direct your questioning. In terms of the linguistics and the things like statement analysis, they have been proven to be very, very powerful techniques used for deception detection. I'm not a linguist myself, so I can't comment too much on that side of things. But from my understanding of the literature and from the work that I have done with colleagues and collaborators, there is some breathtaking research done in this field. And if people are interested in deception detection, statement analysis really is where you should be focusing on. It's like there's just some really simple tricks to implement. And one that I love is changing the way that you tell stories. So if I say to you, okay, where were you last night? And you give me this whole plan of where you were last night. And then I say to you, okay, well, tell me it backwards. Where were you from the end of the night back to the beginning? Because when we construct a lie, we construct it strategically in a certain order. It's the same as if I say to you, okay, tell me A, B, C, D, all the way to Z. Okay, now tell me it backwards. You kind of have to go all A, B, C, D again and again and again just to go back. And it's kind of the same with lying. And a technique like that instantly is already so much more effective than nonverbal communication, deception detection.
And a lot of this deception detection seemed like you were really talking about microexpressions. So what about some of the other things that we've heard about? Like if somebody's rate of speech changes, maybe if somebody's all of a sudden speaking faster, now that indicates deception, or a tapping foot, or maybe they pause and look away before answering, or they answer more quickly. Are any of those things based on science for deception detection?
So great question. They're based in science, in emotional recognition, but not deception detection. Again, it's the same as facial expressions. When we look at body language, all we're picking up is expressions of emotion. We also have to remember that one cue isn't always the same for everybody. So if we say, okay, well, I tap my foot when I'm in high distress, and that's my signal that I'm lying, or am I in high distress, or am I really impatient, or am I really nervous? Do I have high anxiety, or is that just my comfort tick? Or is it just completely unrelated? Same as crossing of the arms. The research on crossing of the arms has shown that when we cross our arms, we're defensive. But it has also shown that when we cross our arms, we're just getting comfortable, or we're just cold. Or it's how human beings typically do sit with their arms by their side, quite relaxed. So we need to consider individual variation. Also, a lot of the deception detection literature doesn't take into consideration things like culture, things like illness. If somebody has a physical or mental sickness, that will affect their nonverbals. We know that mental illness affects the nonverbals. For example, people who have severe depression have slower rates of walking, and the movement of their lower body is much slower. And if you aren't aware of that and you're looking at the movements of their lower body, you might make an incorrect interpretation of what you're seeing because you're not taking those into consideration. So nonverbal communication is an extremely powerful subject, but it's very misunderstood. And there's a lot that we don't know, and there's so much more that we're discovering consistently. In terms of deception detection, we know it doesn't work. You can't detect deception.
And I would think that you're also going to miss on some of the edge cases as well, where there probably are some people who don't care if they're lying or have the ability to, they have the ability to just lie right through their teeth and not even feel a single thing. Or even go back to one of my favorite lines ever from the Seinfeld show is George Costanza, where he said, "It's not a lie if you believe it." And yeah, when you have those kinds of people, there's probably not going to be very much there anyway, even if you did believe in any of these kinds of signs and signals, that you're not going to get any.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also confirmation bias too. So not only are we missing true signals, but we're likely to confirm things if we think, okay, well, they crossed their arms, they're being defensive, so the question that I just asked must have hit a trigger point. And we're likely to self-confirm those things. What is interesting is we know that the effect of cognitive load is kind of where this research has been heading. When we're lying, it's more cognitively demanding because not only are we trying to answer the question, but we're trying to construct a story as well as debate, okay, this needs to be realistic, this needs to be plausible, and control our emotions. So nonverbals do slip because we are so cognitively overloaded. If we are trying to conceal our behaviors and we're really, really nervous and we're trying to conceal, okay, stay calm, you know, don't tap my foot, try not to play with my pen, that is an extra cognitive load. So likely our nonverbals will indicate there is something stressing us out. There is some nervousness there, but also so will our linguistics because we're likely to say the wrong thing or we might slip up with the facts. But again, that is just recognizing the emotional slips. That's just recognizing distress because things like, if you've had an argument prior to coming into this conversation and you're thinking about that argument, that's also going to weigh on your cognitive load. And that might weigh more than, say, if you were lying. It might increase your emotional, it might increase your distress a lot. And then you'll have those behaviors of high distress. It has nothing to do with the question you asked me. It's because I'm so overloaded cognitively with my emotional situation, with the current situation, with trying to mitigate the negative interaction. So there's so much that we're paying attention to that the nonverbals can be very, very informative, but not for what we might think they are.
So like I mentioned earlier, you've basically destroyed a lot of beliefs in the social engineering field or community. What types of things should people look for to know what is good science and what is less good science?
So again, that's a really great question. And this can be a really difficult thing to do, because a lot of the time the people actually expressing the pseudoscience are self-proclaimed experts or people with high authority. So actually, say for example, I did I answered a question recently, like a blog post, and I was asked the question of, are there nonverbal indicators of deception? And I wrote this whole piece on, no, there are none. And I explained where the myth comes from. That newspaper or that website, they quoted me and they took out a section of what I wrote and then wrote, Dr. Abby Morono discusses the nonverbal behaviors associated with deception detection, and then took a quote out of context and then posted it on their site. So it looks like now a behavioral analysis expert is confirming these nonverbal indicators, and here's a quote supporting it. Actually, that was just misquoted in a piece that I was explaining there are no indicators. So it can be really, really difficult. You might look to this and say, okay, well, this is a scientist that I trust, so I'm going to believe this quote, and now I'm going to take on this knowledge and implement it into my practice. This can be really, really dangerous. And again, it's not even because the scientist himself is promoting the bad science, but this happens all the time. And I see this so often from blog posts. So my first tip is validate. Just because a scientist you admire or that you read is quoted saying something doesn't mean they actually said it. Validate that source. Go back to the source where they said it and make sure that that's correct. Also, do not get your information from blogs. And I get so much criticism from saying this, but I will explain. Blog posts, when you submit them, they are pretty much submitted, you know, within 12 hours of published within 12 hours. You know, that is not enough time for peer review. Also, it doesn't go through a peer review process. Also, a blog is subjective. You can talk about how you feel about studies. It's not actually subject to scientific scrutiny. The amount of blog posts I have been sent saying, wow, look at this concept. And then I go to the article and they have exaggerated the claims. A lot of it has actually just been lied. They've misunderstood the methodology or the statistics. And then the study doesn't report an effect size, so you can't really make an accurate judgment of whether those statistics are telling you what they're saying they're telling you. The authors have come to a different conclusion and their discussion is saying something very different than what the blog post is saying. And people get really annoyed by this because they say, well, I'm not going to read the academic article. Well, it's like, well, tough then. If you want the hard science, you have to put in the work to get the hard science. And also, just reading an abstract of an article is misleading, because a lot of the time the abstract is just there to make you read the rest of the paper. And then when you read the paper, one, again, their methodology might be flawed. They might not report their effect sizes. They might have bad statistics. You won't know that until you read the paper. Also, loads of them appear to be saying something very different. And then again, you read the discussion and the effect is much more subdued. And I understand that it's not always appealing to read academic articles. But if you are asking, well, how can I make sure what I'm doing is scientifically valid? You have to read the science. There's no fast track to the science. You have to just get comfortable with reading it, because if you read anything secondhand, you're always going to get secondhand knowledge and a secondhand interpretation of what was found. But it is important to kind of understand what the study is telling you, because just because something is published doesn't mean that it's reliable. Things slip through the cracks. But like I said, you know, I published science and then I developed my understanding, and then I later published something very, very different. And now I publish very differently. People make mistakes. Scientists make mistakes. Science is a field, moves on. And just because a researcher has published something that now doesn't stand doesn't make them a bad researcher, doesn't make them a bad scientist. That's the nature of science. You have to consistently stay up to date because we are consistently learning more. So you might be in the field now and there's loads of studies supporting your claim or supporting this claim that you believe. Maybe next year, lots of replication studies will come out actually showing the effect is slightly different. You have to be adaptable and you have to be willing to give up your understanding. And this is one way to actually identify a practitioner that pushes pseudoscience. Somebody that will not consider an alternative perspective when presented with evidence on the contrary. So if I have one view in a field and then I'm presented with evidence that my view might be flawed, as a scientist, it's my duty to consider that information, evaluate it, and then reconsider my information. If somebody is not willing to do that, they are not a real scientist. It's like I said, you know, I had a lot of pride in the field of lie detection, but it didn't stand up to scrutiny. So I changed my topic. I moved with the science. And that's just what it is to be a researcher, but that's what it also is to be a practitioner that implements science. You have to be willing to adapt your strategy. Like I said, you have to be willing to do the hard reading.
And with that adaptation, you mentioned that cooperation can be more useful. What did you mean by that?
Yes. So we have the dark and the light, I guess, you know, the deception detection and then the influencing cooperation. As a species, we are highly cooperative. In fact, group survival and the ability to facilitate harmonious relationships is the single most important factor in the success of the human species. So the behaviors that facilitate group survival are actually neurologically programmed in us. We neurologically want to cooperate. And we can get into that in a little bit. But detecting deception is very cognitively demanding because we want to cooperate. We want to know straight away, okay, is this someone that I can trust? Is this someone that's going to work with me? Are we going to have a harmonious relationship? If we go in looking for evidence that they're cooperative, all we need to do is see a behavior and then it sways us to that side. If we go in looking for evidence that they are being deceptive, we need to not only identify those cooperative behaviors, but we then have the added pressure of trying to evaluate whether that is true. Are they feigning that? I mean, are they feigning that? Is that a false expression? And that is very cognitively demanding. It would also encroach on our ability to facilitate harmonious relationships if we go into every interaction very skeptical and very paranoid. So that wouldn't be a very good mechanism to push us through evolution. So that's why we often do overlook the deceptive people. However, we are a cooperative species. So the deception detection mechanism is our group. If somebody is a non-cooperator, it's not going to take long for everybody in that group to know that. All they have to do is not cooperate once or be untrustworthy once. And then because of group survival and gossip, it gets around the social group. So we haven't needed to detect deception because we have because we've evolved to cooperate, and that facilitates harmony.
And one of the things that we also like to do here is to help people protect themselves against social engineers or people with malicious intent. Do you have any kind of advice for people on how they could pick up on some of this deception or lack of cooperation, things that they should specifically look for?
Being aware of the techniques that people use to create rapport, create comfort, create trustworthiness can help you identify if they're false. But to be honest, it's very, very difficult to identify false behaviors unless you have long-term interactions with them. Because first impressions are really, really powerful. And it's very difficult to identify whether someone actually is very trustworthy or they're just very, very read up on what creates a trustworthy perception. What we can do, though, is trust but verify. Because I would never, ever say to someone, go into every relationship being skeptical, because that, again, is a recipe for disaster, because it's not going to facilitate harmonious relationships and it's not going to facilitate healthy relationships. But trust but verify. Because if somebody is saying something that seems too good to be true, obviously that's instantly a red flag. But if it seems reliable, they seem great, they seem trustworthy, you feel very, very comfortable, don't just give them everything. Always validate the information. And a trustworthy person and an honest person isn't going to be offended if you say, yep, absolutely, I'm just going to verify this, because they have nothing to hide. As soon as somebody is a bit, you know, cautious and say, well, you know, why do you need to verify? That instantly is a red flag for you. Whether it's a professional relationship, a personal relationship, if they feel threatened by you wanting to verify or validate, then that is absolutely a red flag.
I'm really enjoying this conversation and hearing the scientific side and hearing the research side. And I think other people might be super interested in this as well and would love to hear more of these topics from you. And I believe that you have your own podcast that just came out. What is that going to be all about?
Yes. So at Social Engineer, we have just started a new psychology-focused podcast. So we really want to make science and psychology accessible to everybody. So myself and Chris Hadnagy, we will be doing a podcast every month, but if it is of interest, we're likely to be doing it a little bit more regularly. I'm hoping that we can, but for the minute, it's every month. And it's going to be about a different psychological concept each time. So we have just recorded our first episode, and we thought we'd jump right in and talk about subliminal persuasion. Because when I say psychology, people instantly think, oh my God, you know, can you read my mind? So we thought, okay, well, let's dive into mind control via subliminal persuasion. Is there any science to it? Can we influence people to make decisions and act in ways that isn't in their best interest, or maybe in my best interest, without them consciously realizing? And the episode after that, we're going to be talking about, can you fake it till you make it? So faking confidence, you know, telling ourselves that we can do something, and does that actually increase our ability to be able to do it? We're going to be talking about facial feedback, and an interesting little teaser. We're going to be talking about the use of Botox for treatment of mental health disorders such as depression. So lots of really exciting things we're going to be diving into the psychology of. And we really want, like I said, to make the psychology accessible to the everyday person. So if you are a businessman or woman, or you are a student, or you are a practitioner, or you're a scientist, there's going to be something in there for everybody. And everything's going to be explained at a basic level. And then we'll be diving into a bit of neuroscience, a bit of biology, and a bit of neuromarketing each time. So we think that it should be a lot of fun.
So that sounds like that would be a great podcast for listeners of this one who want to learn more about social engineering. And I know you just described that it can be beneficial to lots of different fields, but it sounds like it can also be super beneficial to people looking to learn social engineering, where you're going to pull out the science part of it, you're going to pull out the research and explain, you know, the science behind all of that, while you also have Chris on there, who is then also able to take the science that you're describing and apply it into the field of social engineering and describe more about, this is how social engineers might use this science that you're describing. Does that sound like it is probably along the lines of what you have in mind?
Yeah, exactly. Because we're not just talking about, you know, if, say, for example, the topic of rapport, you know, if we create rapport, it can create information elicitation. And that's usually where it ends. Okay, let's take rapport and then create information elicitation. What we want to do is dive into Why? What are the psychological mechanisms involved in that relationship? Because if we understand psychologically why things work, we can utilize that understanding to make them work much more effectively. And the implementation of psychology and social engineering, I mean, I think this is a given. I get the question, you know, oh, how did you think about exploring psychology within social engineering? Which is crazy to me, because social engineering is psychology. Understanding how to influence people, that's psychology. Understanding how to make people feel more comfortable so they tell you things, that's psychology. Every single aspect of social engineering is psychology, because it involves human beings. Even cyber threats, you have one person at one end creating the cyber threat. It doesn't come out of nowhere, although there's technology between the sender and the receiver, there's still a sender and there's still a receiver. So every aspect of social engineering is touched by psychology. And this is what we're going to explore.
So you have that podcast where people can hear more from you, which I'm really looking forward to listening to all of those episodes as they come out each month. But has there been any other places, any other presentations, videos, anything like that, that people can see more of your work?
Yes. So on my website, which is just abbymoreno.com, I've got a selection of podcasts and videos and media outputs there. I've also got links to my peer-reviewed publications, to blog posts, to questions on websites that I've answered and things like that. So you can see a lot of my media outputs there. Also on LinkedIn, which is, I believe, Dr. Abby Moreno, and then Twitter, which I believe is Abby J. Moreno. I think those are correct.
This has been an incredible discussion with you. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Abby Moreno.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.